Now, Peter Munvies was marketing director for Columbia Records in New York, had a very long career with them. At the time that they were releasing the Cleveland Orchestra recordings on the Columbia Masterworks and Epic labels. He's a fascinating character. I think you're going to be entertained and informed. Peter Munvies.
I set out to build an orchestra which would combine the best qualities of the fine European orchestras, pre-war period, even pre-First World War period, with the finest qualities of the American orchestras in their best period. That is the impeccable intonation, the impeccable virtuosity, the brilliance, the smoothness of execution, which very often in America was an end in itself. And these qualities I wanted as the premise on which to build, as the precondition, and I wanted to combine this with the spontaneity, the warmth, the flexibility of the best European orchestras and the tradition consciousness and the familiarity with the good musical habits, let's say, the musical virtues of the best European orchestras, with particular emphasis on ensemble playing to the point of chamber musical feeling of each other while playing, not just simply playing notes following a stick, but for the individual member not to play his part only, but play the whole piece and be in it, even if his part shows 40 bars of rest.
Okay, Zell wrote, and this is a quote from an interview in High Fidelity that Paul Henry Lang, a wonderful musicologist, made with him in 61. If an orchestra, he's expanding on what he says here now, is trained to honest chamber music-like playing with the result that every player in every section plays every note with the proper articulation and emphasis in dynamics, the task of the conductor is made very much easier. Then he can put together a few strands which already are clean and balance them properly. Now, Zell's Mozart was a great Mozart conductor, is a tremendous case in point, because you hear every line cleanly. The articulation is incredible. There is no orchestra today that I know of that plays this way and plays with this brio and this feeling. And what makes Zell's Mozart so lovable is its humanity. His earliest training occurred in the opera house, and he brought to Cleveland a full awareness of the dramatic urgency, the vocal inflections, the human frailties and emotions of the characters that we love so well in Mozart's comic operas. And just because Mozart's instrumental and orchestral music has no words, no dramatic scenario, doesn't mean that it does not imply a scenario. And I'm going to take a liberty here, and in the presto from the youthful 28th Symphony that we're about to hear, one can easily imagine a scenario right out of The Marriage of Figaro. The opening theme of the presto, played by the first violins, could easily be a coloratura aria, complete with fancy turns. This is accompanied by a racing figure in the second violins. And the soprano voices of the violins portray the countess and her maid flitting about in an 18th century boudoir. Suddenly, there is a knock at the door. It is the count. The count is convinced that he's being hoodwinked, and his countess is hiding a lover in her bedroom. All right, the count is portrayed by the lowest strings, the winds and the brass. All right, he interrupts the gaiety of the ladies three times. Finally, we get a tremendous outburst. And then, of course, the Countess explains everything away that she's absolutely innocent in a very lyrical passage. All right, I'll shut up and let Zell do the playing. Here, let's have the music.
Normally, the music lover will associate the chamber quality with a small ensemble and therefore will expect that everything that has chamber as a prefix will be small and thin. The opposite is the fact. The special quality, or one of the special qualities of the Cleveland Orchestra, I think, is that while it is an orchestra of over 100 players, and while it has this very rich, expansive sound, they still can play together with so much mutual rapport as four players in a string quartet.
The Cleveland Orchestra's unique combination of a rich, expansive sound with the mutual rapport of four players in a string quartet, that's what Zell was trying, and that's what he wanted to get, and he got it. And it's nowhere more apparent than in another a great composer who wrote hundreds of songs just like Mozart. This composer was Robert Schumann. And on the occasion of the 150th anniversary of the composer's birth, he wrote a wonderful article in New York Times, and he answered the charge that Schumann did not know how to write for the instruments of the orchestra. And this is what he wrote. It is simply not true. His imagination of phrases or passages for the individual instrument is vivid and accurate. Let us only remember that the oboe melody of the Adagio of the Second Symphony, the clarinet tune in the third movement of the Rhenish, the innumerable bravura passages for horns in all the symphonies, the use of the brass choir in the fourth movement of the Rhenish, the horn and flute cadenza in the first, the dazzling moto perpetuo-like strings in the scherzo of the second, which is what we're going to hear now. We're going to hear the conclusion of this boisterously frolicsome scherzo. Note the precision and at the same time freedom of phrasing and unanimity of bowing in the strings. Every note is articulated. The tricky passage we are about to hear marks a transition from the slow middle section to the original animated tempo with which the scherzo begins. Note the cat and mouse game between the winds, bum, and the strings, da, bum, bum, going back and forth, and the accelerando gradually speeding up and leading back to the opening tempo. And once there, the subtle retard, and I'll make a sign with my hand when it comes in the strings, and then the bracing coda in a lickety-split double time finish, a virtuoso tour de force of orchestral playing.
Time.
George Zell revealed to me the anatomy of the score. That's how clear and clean those lines were. And he animates me. I can't help myself. I must conduct when I hear this music. I mean, it's impossible. The kinetic energy just leaps off the record. Now, I want to tell you, George Zell made Schumann's symphonies listenable by thinning out Schumann's textures, eliminating doublings, adding or changing notes to clarify themes, adjusting dynamics, and changing certain timpani notes, impractical in Schumann's day, to conform with the harmony. His goal was to make the symphony sound, and I quote him, as if Schumann had as much knowledge of orchestration as Weber, but not as much as Richard Strauss. Very, very clever. Well, one Cleveland Orchestra player told me, if you really want to know how great we are, come to our rehearsals. We start rehearsing where most orchestras leave off. Howard Scott, Zell's first recording director at Columbia Masterworks, tells it this way.
A George Zell rehearsal was better than the concerts sometimes. They were so great. I mean, he would really rehearse, and then he could fine-tune, if you will. It's like a motor. He would take it and he'd check the little clicks. There'd be no clicks, and all the cylinders would be purring perfectly. There was really no, quote, splicing.
Now, if you coast along at rehearsals, you cannot expect the orchestra to play with the singers or whoever it is with full participation. But if you start a rehearsal in the attitude that you are now conducting for keeps, to use an American slang expression, a performance, and you'll stop only if something goes wrong or if something is so contrary to your wishes, or if you cannot enforce by gesture and other nonverbal means your intentions, then you'll get the rehearsal right away into a different groove and on a higher level.
Just a shade late, some of the horns. You must be prepared way ahead of time. I can't do better than to repeat this truism I think I said yesterday. Rests aren't there to rest, but to be braced for the next entry, to prepare and to be ready for it and to listen what's going on around you and to bring your next entry in so it makes sense and connects. To be ready with your breath, with your embouchure, everything, and with your general attitude. It's no use if five horns play and two are late. It's two printed fortissimos back from the double bar. Is that correct? Resolution, alive. No crescendo. Suspense. Quick crescendo yet. Piano. Two, then one forte and two fortes. Yes, these repeated down bows have to be longer, not 50% bow, 50% retrieve, but pa pa. Very uncomfortable, very difficult to do, but the only way to get it off. Now, this I will not do now.
George Zell had it all. He had the body gestures. He had the facial expressions, his eyes, everything. He was a consummate conductor. There wasn't one wasted motion in rehearsal or in performances. Now, during recording sessions, Zell would never resort to a lot of little inserts. His recordings were essentially performances in long, long takes with only a few patches to fix exposed wrong notes or poor intonation, etc. He told Paul Myers, his recording producer in the 60s, that he hated his recording of the Sibelius Second Symphony, thankfully not with the Cleveland Orchestra, but with the Concertgebouw Orchestra, because the orchestra couldn't play the scherzo, and the finished recording was assembled from a lot of little takes, what he called a patch cobbler's job. But with his Cleveland Orchestra, things were quite different. Howard Scott tells us what it was like recording Zell in Cleveland.
There was really no, quote, splicing. We would do a section, or we would do something that he'd say, I can do better than that, or we can get a, he never was personal. We can get a better balance. Not Howard, you didn't do it right, or he'd go out and talk to the brass, or the strings, or the winds, and say, let me fix this. And I'd say, well, I can fix that in editing. He says, no, I don't want you to fix it in editing. I want to fix it. I'm the guy who makes the balances. George knew that I was trying to get the best for him, his ideas or his interpretation, not mine. I didn't care if it was too fast. There was one incident where he let me get away with it. We were doing Prokofiev's Fifth Symphony. It's a great recording. And we got through the first movement, and we got to the second movement, which is the fast movement. I sound like Peter Mundry's.
Very good.
Right?
Absolutely.
Okay, that's about the tempo he took it to.
Yeah, wonderful.
And it was a fabulous performance. You know, the middle part slows down.
Right.
And then it slowly speeds up and comes back to exactly the same tempo as it starts, supposedly. And most conductors, you hear that, they can't hit that accelerando on the button. It takes a little couple more bars maybe to adjust it too fast, too slow, whatever. George hit that sucker right on the nose. Take one. Now he comes in to listen to it and he says, Howard, that's a wonderful performance. The balance is one. It's a wonderful performance, but it's too fast. I'm going to have to do it again. I said, no, you aren't. He says, Howard, it's too fast. I don't want it that way. I have to do it again. I said, George, we can do it 100 times. You will never be able to splice anything. You will never be able to get the performance you got out of it. This was a sensational performance. It was perfectly balanced. There wasn't one clam in the orchestra.
Yeah.
Nothing. There were not intonations, not entrances, not nothing. It's perfect the way you want it. Please, don't change it. That's the take, and I'm not going to let you do it again.
So
he looked at me and said, Howard, okay. And when he said okay,
thank you.
play would sell. Paul Myers told me an amusing story about a rehearsal of the slow movement of Haydn's 93rd Symphony. A musical joke occurs at the end of this movement. Haydn sets it up with superb comic timing. Towards the end of this andante, the orchestra, with its full complement of strings, winds, and brass, restates the main theme in a march-like passage. Then, suddenly, the music grows very quiet, as strings and winds play a game of cat and mouse, interspersed with rests and muffled beats from the timpani. Finally, there's a really long pause, and then, seemingly out of nowhere, a rude blast from the bassoon. Sell was unhappy with the way the bassoonist played this basso buffo outburst. It was too correct, too timid. You know, he said, Haydn had a funny kind of barnyard sense of humor. Think of yourself on a farm surrounded by animals. One of them is an ass. Just think of this ass passing gas. The orchestra burst out in gales of laughter, and Zell got what he wanted. Zell conducted this symphony at a concert I attended. Aware of this story, I went backstage to pay my respects to the maestro. Dr. Zell, I beamed. We now have a new nickname for a Haydn symphony. Everybody knows about the Paukenverbal, the drum roll, the Paukenschlag, the surprise, and der Abschied, the farewell. And now, I held my breath, we have, thanks to you, die Fahrt. Zell grinned ear to ear. He knew exactly the passage to which I was referring. Zell's droll sense of humor led him to rediscover a lost passage for the third and fourth horns in Brahms's Academic Festival Overture. Zell had an amazing memory. He remembered, as a young man in Berlin and Vienna, hearing orchestras play a very sassy raspberry at one point in the score. But he hadn't heard it in years. Was it his imagination? Had he actually heard it? He consulted an autographed score, and sure enough, there it was, a raucous belly laugh for horns that may have been dropped by conductors who either did not have the full complement of horns or simply decided it was far too difficult to play. So at the point in the score we're going to hear, upper winds sing a sarcastic student song. They are then joined by another group of students, obviously upperclassmen because we hear quite prominently the bassoon, lower voices. Finally, the whole crowd of students, that's the full orchestra, takes it up as the full orchestra comes charging in. Towards the end of this big passage, you'll hear the third and fourth horns raising Cain as only college students can. To this day, Zell's recording of the Academic Festival remains the only one to restore this impudent raspberry. Very hard.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
You're probably wondering what NBC and those notorious chimes that used to be associated with Toscanini and the NBC Orchestra, Jack Benny, Fred Allen, Bergen and McCarthy, Fibber McGee and Molly, and a host of other great entertainment stars in the 30s and 40s, have to do with George Zell and the Cleveland Orchestra, and thereby hangs a tale. It was 1963, and Jane Friedman, an executive in the Artists and Repertoire Department, set up a luncheon between herself, Dr. Zell, and yours truly. Columbia Masterworks at that time had an embarrassment of riches when it came to leading orchestras. Both Bernstein and New York Philharmonic, thanks to incredible television exposure, and Ormity and the Philadelphia Orchestra were outselling the Cleveland. And on top of that, we had Bruno Walter. But Bruno Walter had just died the year before, and we were able, at that time, we had sent Zell to Epic so that he would be the only orchestra on Epic Records, which was a sister label of Columbia Masterworks. Well, we were able to bring him back now, and he was back at Columbia. But the sales department was giving us pressure for Zell to record more popular repertoire. Well, so Zell arrived at the luncheon hardly in a jovial mood, since he had just had a wisdom tooth pulled and was recovering from the after effects of Novocaine. "Maestro," I began, "we all love the many wonderful recordings you have made for us, but both Bernstein and Ormity are outselling the Cleveland because they're recording popular war horses." "Like what?" he demanded. I plunged in, "Like Bolero, Scheisse," said Zell. "What else?" "1812, double Scheisse." "Anything else?" "What about Scheherazade?" "Oh no, not on your life. This is really Scheißdreck." I was getting nowhere fast. "You won't," I pleaded, "even record Rossini's William Tell Overture. And that's a first-class piece of music." "I agree with you," he replied. "But a few seasons ago, I play it, and after the opening trumpet fanfare in the gallop, bump, ba-da-dum, ba-da-dum, ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba, there's a rest. And during that rest, a clown in the balcony yells out, 'Hi-yo, Silva!'" "What, I'm thinking, has 'Hi-yo, Silva' got to do with the William Tell Overture?" After the concert, one of my players told me that this tune was the theme of a very popular television western called The Lone Ranger. And that's what he cried, sitting atop his white horse, Silver, in his mask at the beginning and the end of each program. That ruined the piece for me. I don't watch television. I'm too busy with my scores. How was I to know about Hi-yo, Silva? But I protested, "You recorded Capriccio Italian and Capriccio Espanol." "Yes," he replied, "that's as low as I go." There was a big pause in the conversation at this point. Getting his second wind, Zell mounted an offensive attack for one of the most unsaleable pieces ever recorded. With a twinkle in his eye, and I knew I was in for it, he proclaimed, "Next year, 1964, is the 100th anniversary of the birth of Richard Strauss, and I will make for you the greatest recording of Richard Strauss's Sinfonie Domestica you or anyone else has ever heard." "Come on," I persisted, "even Fritz Reiner and the Chicago Symphony can't sell it." "Who?" he replied. "Who were they to prevent me from adding my performance to the catalog?" Clearly, I hadn't done my homework. If I had known at the time that Zell was Richard Strauss's protege, who launched him on his career when he was but a young man of 19, and that he'd been a lifelong champion of Strauss, I certainly would have been on surer ground. But I held fast. "Look, maestro, we're in business to sell records. The Sinfonie Domestica is not first-rate Strauss. It's not one of his greatest hits. It's not Don Juan. It's not Till Eulenspiegel. It's not even Death and Transfiguration. It's an overblown work with a lot of boring passages to the average classical devotee." "I see your point," he replied, "but this can be changed with the kind of spectacular sound Paul Myers, Frank Bruno, and Boudet, that's how he pronounced Buddy, Boudet Graham, are giving me in Cleveland. You know," and he was off on a lecture of just how spectacularly scored Domestica was. I kept interjecting that it will be a hard sell. He says, "No, no, with me it'll be a soft sell." "Besides," he concluded, "you need a Sinfonie Domestica in your catalog. You don't have one." "I checked," he said with a wrinkle of his eye. He had me on that one. Now he played his trump card. "You know the finale is a gigantic fugue, a musical portrait of a good-natured spat between Strauss and his wife. Strauss pulls out all the stops. It has real virtuoso passages for the brass, especially the trumpets and horns, and the whole battery of percussion is going this way and that way, and the strings are swirling around. It's a gigantic fugue with many different thematic lines going all at once. It's the kind of music made for my thoroughbred orchestra. They'll play it magnificently. Why, with your spectacular sound, you'll be able to hear clearly and distinctly every single thematic nuance, every melodic thread in this densely written fugue. It'll be a revelation." The more Zell talked, the more excited he got about making the Sinfonie Domestica. Then I played my trump card. "I'm very sorry, maestro. You cannot record that fugue for us. Why not? He pressed on. Because, I gloated, I was sure I had him this time. Do you know what the final three chords of that fugue are? So what, he says. What do they have to do with making Sinfonia Domestica for you? Those three chords, I said, just happen to be the most famous sound logo in the world, and they don't belong to us. In fact, they belong to our arch rival, the National Broadcasting Company. Do you think William Paley, who was fighting a pitched battle with the NBC to lure all their stars to CBS, is going to let you promote the National Broadcasting Company on a Columbia record? As Zell got up to leave, he gave me a glowering look. I knew I was in for it. Mr. Munvies, he said, in his best Otto Preminger style, you have an amazing memory for shit. Zell's recording of Domestica was chosen as the best recording of the Strauss year by all critics, hands down. Reiner's older recording wasn't even in the running because it wasn't made during the Strauss year. It was a great triumph for George Zell and the Cleveland Orchestra, and it remains to this day the most viscerally exciting performance and recording of that fugue on or off records. So Zell and the Cleveland had the last laugh. Now, before I go, I just want to thank the following people who helped me make this presentation possible. John Kulsour, Ray Edwards, VAI International, Carol Jacobs, archivist, the Cleveland Orchestra, Bill Klinger, Paul Myers, former A&R Director, Columbia Masterworks and Decca Records, Howard Scott, former A&R Director of Columbia Masterworks and Epic Records, Louise Spear, Program Chair, Ars Convention, Warren Wernick, Sony Masterworks, and Michael Chary, is it? Michael Chary, who was the assistant conductor with Zell for a long time. And by last and no means least, Seth Winter, recording engineer for the Rodgers and Hammerstein Archives of Recorded Sound, who put up with all my nonsense and all my retakes. Thank you very, very much. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Oh, tell them about the meeting tonight.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, the Zell room.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
We'll take two questions before we go.
Oh, I have one announcement to make. At 8 o'clock tonight in the George Zell room of the hotel, there will be a round table on record collecting by all of the record collectors who want to come. And we have quite a panel. I'll be there, and there'll be an awful lot there. They'll be reminiscing, because I think record collectors are the glue that keeps the industry going, and it still keeps it going. They're the most optimistic people in the world, because record collectors, it's not what they've got, it's what they're going to get. All right. Do you have any questions?
Brahms D minor, go ahead.
Well, you want me to tell you the Brahms D minor?
It's all a quick one.
All right. This is one story. George Zell had made this the stereo recording of the Brahms D minor concerto in Cleveland with Rudolf Serkin. And, you know, they had the same piano professor together in Berlin. But anyway, George Zell gets the test pressing in advance, and he says to Paul Myers, "Too much orchestra, not enough piano." So Serkin gets the test pressing. He says, too much piano, not enough orchestra. That's what he says. All right. So he says, yes, of course, Zell wants the orchestra. So he says, too much piano, not enough orchestra. So Serkin gets it, and he says, too much orchestra, not enough piano. That's it. So, you know, so Myers is in a quandary. He doesn't know what to do. But he says, so he figures in a concerto, the soloist is the boss. So he puts the record out. And 2 weeks later, we read on the cover of Billboard magazine, George Zell holds an improvisatory press conference announcing that Columbia Masterworks will recall defective pressings of the Brahms D minor concerto, or else, and that's it.
Wait a minute, do the gutter, do the gutter.
No.
That's enough.
Later.
Tonight, ladies, go out.
Thank you, Peter. Happily, Peter will be with us through the rest of the conference, so you can meet up with him, buy him a beer or something, and keep talking. Bob, I'd like to ask you to lead us over to Severance Hall. I think we're about right on time.